Welcome to Passion to Power with your host, Michelle Zeitlin. She's a creative producer who quote-unquote wears many hats. She's also a talent and literary manager and founded the company Morzap Productions and Management. She develops people and projects across all media. Her guests encompass the gamut, from artists to authors, actors to activists, programming executives, development executives, and A&R. Michelle Zeitlin is excited to share her tips and tools for success through her conversations mostly via Zoom during quarantine. Please welcome Michelle Zeitlin, Passion to Power.
Today I'm here with Blair Taylor, who is a dear friend. Probably over 20 years we've been doing business together. He is an exceptionally talented entrepreneur who has put together $1 million and maybe more than $1 million endorsement deals for his clients. He's worked as a commercial agent. He has created an entrepreneurial business, and I am so impressed as another entrepreneur who's had to morph and change and shift and pivot. We are all in quarantine and many people are suffering, enduring, and yet here is Blair, who from all standpoints seems to be thriving, has a baby, an infant baby that he's raising, and has incredible opportunities for his clients. So without further ado, Blair, would you say your full name for us?
Blair Taylor.
Listen to that voice. You see, he could also do voiceover and announcer.
And I have a middle, you said full name, Michelle, and I actually have a middle initial, which is J. It doesn't stand for anything, so it's Blair.
But I see that you often have that in your email, Blair J. Taylor.
Yeah, doesn't mean anything. People say, what's it mean? Means nothing.
Means nothing. It just means that the other Blair Taylor on the plane doesn't have your seat.
That's right. And by the way, I grew up in Wisconsin. There's a Blair Taylor High School. Go figure.
Right. And the other thing I remembered when I saw your bio is that you went to school in Madison, Wisconsin, and I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin.
It's a great, great school, great city. And I haven't been back in a long time, but it was a fantastic.
I haven't been back since I'm 14.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's only 2 years ago.
Give me a snapshot. So we don't need the origin story necessarily, but I'd love to have your snapshot, how you sort of perceive your business, what got you into doing what you're doing, because this podcast is for people who aspire to be the arts and entertainment, and also many of our colleagues and peers.
Perfect. So, you know, I've been in working in the commercial agency business for almost 25 years. And started with one of the big agencies where I trained, moved to another agency where I was there for many, many, many years. And what I was recognizing is that the business was just changing, right? The entertainment business is changing. And when you're working for an organization that's almost, it's just kind of settled and stuck in its ways, that it wasn't adapting to the change. And I was fearing and I was concerned that the agency that I worked for just wasn't making those changes, right? And I decided that in order to accomplish that I had to start my own company, which is exactly what I did. So I did that almost 2.5 years ago, and I've been on my own since then, and a decision I should have made many years ago, but one I'm glad that I eventually made.
Well, the overhead's less or more, what? Now that we're working remotely, everyone's working from home. So this is where you do business.
This thing lets you do business, right? Our business, from where I sit. What was that?
We have to tell people, since this is a podcast, what you're doing. You were holding up your phone.
Oh, sure. No, we got it. Exactly. So the thing that's really interesting about what we do is it's a business of relationships, right? So that's where your value is. I call it your currency. So once you have your currency, you can take that anywhere. And so, you know, having 25 plus years in the business, you develop a lot of currency, you know, a lot of people. So, you know, I feel comfortable that when I place a phone call to a casting director, a production company, that they'll pick up the call and talk to me. And that's the value, right? So the value is greater. Your own reputation and network in the business is greater than perhaps the agency or the umbrella that you work under. And I realize that to be true.
So what are you focusing on now?
Well, you know, I've always worked in the commercial endorsement space and in the hosting infomercial. I call it product-related hosting. So HSN, QVC, infomercials, regular TV commercials, celebrity endorsements. And that's where I've maintained I shifted from my old agency to what I'm doing now, really doing the same thing. We do it a little bit differently now because viewership in television is dropping, right? So you have to be aware of those other media that are available, like digital. What does that look like? And what do influencers look like? And what's the power of an influencer? And so you just have to learn to adapt and see what's happening in your business and then just, you know, step into that new space prepared and ready to serve those.
How important is that, Blair, when you're doing a deal, the influence?
You know, it's interesting. I think people, you mean as far as using an influencer? Or
the word, I mean, it's a new word, right? An influencer. It used to be someone of influence, right? So now we use that as a word. It's a tag. It started, I think, with YouTube. How important is that for you in closing and getting deals?
You know, it's interesting. There's a couple of different let's just talk about that word for a second. So I feel like I'm an influencer. I'm not an influencer through social media, but within the business that I work, I have influence, right? So companies, production companies, casting directors will call me and they will seek my guidance, my opinion, and counsel to help them, right? So in that way, I have influence. Now what's happened is all these more or less the younger generation has jumped onto Instagram and Facebook and TikTok and they acquire these followers, and then these big brands have thought, well, there's a way to get to those followers, right? I can go to these influencers, these people that have an audience, and I can pay them money and access their audience. Well, my experience has been that it hasn't turned out as well as I think people thought, right? Because I think people turn to an influencer or someone perhaps, there's also a difference between someone who has a large social media following and someone who actually has influence, right? Because you can have a lot of people that you can have someone on social media that has a big following, but they don't have influence. So there's a difference between a large following and influence. We might log on to someone because they make really funny TikTok videos, and they might have millions of people that love the entertainment aspect of what the content that they put out, but it doesn't necessarily translate to, oh yeah, and by the way, buy this car, you know, buy this particular product or buy this phone. So it doesn't always translate, right?
How do you test that? What are the metrics for that? How do you know if someone who has a million followers is not really influential in sales?
It's really, really, really hard. I think it's a crapshoot.
You know? Really?
I don't think there's a science behind it. I did a deal for someone, and I'm going to protect who this is, but social media influence of over 100 million people.
Okay.
And we attached a brand to this person, which, by the way, the campaign consisted of social media and print and TV. It was a multi-layered campaign, but social media was the quickest way to get out of the gate. And this person launched and announced the launch of her relationship with this brand through social media, and it did not affect sales of the product. It was negligible. And when I mean negligible, I mean maybe less than 100 sales came from that. This is someone who has 100 million followers, right? So I think if you just go to your social media followers, or excuse me, you go to your social media influencers and expect that just because they have an audience, that audience buys from them. Because the audience doesn't always turn to an influencer for advice or guidance, or sometimes they just tune in because they, as I said before, they just like to see the entertainment that comes out of that, or the lifestyle that comes from that person. But they're not necessarily logging on to be sold something, right? You know, I think you have bloggers that do that, and I think that's really important. So you have like mommy bloggers that speak of their experience, and these are really popular, and they build an audience where their whole point is to share with us the mistakes and the trials and tribulations that they're going through so that we can learn, right? Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned at the top of our conversation that it became a daddy. So our son is 5 months old, and bloggers, if you read like daddy bloggers and parent blogs, you get to learn like, oh, this product is, they found that this product works better than this product. So I'm likely to go on that little journey with them because they speak from a very specific place, right? And so I think bloggers is a little bit different than someone who just has millions of followers. And I think brands make that mistake. I think, you know, I have this happen a lot where a brand will come to me and say, we want this person to post for us. And I'll say, well, we're trying to create a bigger relationship than a single post. And then they say to me, well, we want to test it. And I said, I'm going to tell you exactly what the result is. The result will be a fail. Because you have an expectation that because they have 200,000 followers, that you're going to get 1,000 sales out of it. And you're not, you know. The public can see through that. You know, it's kind of like watching TV. You might see that same commercial over and over and over. And, you know, and it's that same, the same thing. And it doesn't even register. And then one day you need that thing. And that commercial comes on. You're like, oh, yeah, that thing. Right? But it's got to be kind of, in my opinion, is that it has to kind of just live and exist organically and over time. And so a social media post doesn't really allow that to happen. So I think that's tough.
What you're telling me is so interesting because it kind of negates so much of what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
And what?
Well, you know, as an agent, it would be really great for me to use that as a selling point to a brand, right?
Right.
You need to go to a brand and go, this person has, 100 million followers. So you need to pay them $500,000, right? Because here's what's really interesting, Michelle, is like I represent clients on the show, the doctors, right? And I'm going to just, the numbers I'm going to share with you are just making up. But the doctors has, let's say, an average daily viewership of 1 million people. Okay. And so a brand goes to the doctors and says, I want to be on your show. I want to be a sponsor. I want you to do a segment. And the doctor says, and by the way, all these TV shows do this. They say, okay, it's $50,000, right? So it's $50,000 for you to have your product mentioned on our show in the context of a segment, right? So they write a check for $50,000 and they're getting access on TV to, let's say, 1 million people. Well, imagine as an agent, I say, well, 1 million people, I can give you 100 million people. And I'm not going to charge you 50,000. I'll charge you 250,000. I'll just charge you 5 times more, but you're going to get an audience that's 100 times more. And to them, they think that's the greatest thing in the world because it's about eyeballs. They're buying eyeballs, but buying eyeballs on TV is different than buying eyeballs through social media, right? So you're just not going to get the same bang for your buck. So some of these brands, well, I think they've been burned, right? So they go out and they write big checks and there's no payback. And it's from a metric standpoint, it's hard to track that. But a show like The Doctors, it's on every day. So your viewers get used to the hosts and they trust them and they feel like they know them and they follow their journey. So when a product is dropped into the the show, people have a familiarity, right? It's real. It's not just a post. It's you've spent an hour on TV with watching these people. So you just have time to kind of build that relationship. So in my mind, spending $50,000 for perhaps a much smaller segment of the population might result in better exposure for your brand, right? Because we're a society, we just swipe, 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 swipe. So it lives. TV, we don't. TV, we is a different behavior. TV, we sit down and we take it in. Social media isn't that way. It's a filler. It's a filler. It's a time suck. And I think when you absorb it differently, because we absorb it differently, our responses to what we're receiving is different.
It's interesting you mentioned this, because I did a conversation recently with an executive who said they think the reason Quibi is having a hard time finding their footing is because they didn't analyze the behavior. That if you're going to make premium content for a tiny device, you don't really read your audience, which doesn't want really premium content or doesn't care because they're used to watching such short form.
Yes, I totally agree. And also that came out during the pandemic, which is interesting because, you know, when Quibi came out, which COVID, I think had just, it was just about the time COVID hit. And so people were glued to their TVs. They wanted to know what was going on. They were not sitting on buses, trains, subways, where they had many bits of time to fill, right? I mean, Michelle, I sat on the couch and just watched like, you know, 5 and 6 episodes of my favorite television shows. So I was watching 5, 6, 7 hours of programming in chunks. And Quibi is like, what, like short, it's short. It's just naps to a busy life. Right now we don't have a busy life. I think they launched at just a really unfortunate time.
So many. I mean, HBO Max too. I mean, it's just so many of the plans, and look at how many layoffs have come out of that.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers is just striking. It's very hard to read the media landscape. No one really is an expert, right?
For sure. But the thing that's really interesting that we know is that people still want content, right? And advertisers still need to advertise. So those two things, despite what's going on in the world, those two things are still a constant. We just have to, again, we have to figure out what does it look like moving forward.
What tools do you offer and what can you offer in terms of right now? What's the best way to package your presentation?
Wow. Two pieces of advice. One of them is a piece of advice, and the other one is just a statement that I kind of live by, right? The first piece of advice is to be authentically yourself.
Yep.
I think that's really important. I think too many people try really hard to try to be someone else for the person they think they need to be someone else for. And I see this with actors, right? An actor will walk into a room, like you'll have a conversation with an actor, and I do this a lot in meetings. So we have this conversation, it's really nice. And then we're like, okay, well, we just want you to read some commercial copy. And they become an entirely different human being. Or they step into a meeting and they're in a, you know, button up with this, and they're it's all uncomfortable. And you can tell they're just not being their authentic self, right? And sometimes that even shows in things like a headshot. Like, this isn't you. Like, I see this a lot with men, where I'm like, you're wearing this suit because you think you need to wear a suit in the shot, but the suit that you're wearing is really old, and I know that you haven't worn this suit in 2 or 3 years, and it's ill-fitting, and if you were really a guy that wore a suit, you wouldn't wear the suit. Like, you just find people who deviate from their own authenticity.
Got it.
Try to be something they think other people want them to be. I live in my authenticity. I don't hide anything. I say what I say. I'm unapologetic. I try to step through the world being kind and nice and respectful of people, but I think it's really important to be who we are authentically, especially now, because I think people are really searching for that. They like to see that, right? They want to see authenticity. And you know, it's really interesting, and I'm not going to make this a political conversation, but some people like Donald Trump and some people don't like Donald Trump. And the people that like him for exactly who he is, because he shows you who he is, I think. And there's people that like that. And I think, you know, there's something about that where I go, okay, he's being authentic to who he is. And if I dare say my respect for him, not of him, but my respect for him is that he is authentically who he is. Like, he's not apologetic about who he is. I think that's an extreme example, but I think being authentic.
Narcissists never apologize.
And that's right. I mean, and I realize that that's you know, an extreme example, but I do have appreciation for people that walk the walk, talk the talk, whether it's someone like, I don't know, like, you know, Al Gore, who after he left office, or Ed Begley Jr., both very climate focused men, right? And there's people in the world that think Ed Begley Jr. is crazy because he bikes everywhere and he's, you know, he speaks to living a really green environment, but he lives it.
That's him, yeah.
It's him, and I have a respect for that. Yes. And I don't have to always agree with people, but the thing that I'm able to really see is people's authenticity, right? So I think that's really important. So that's my piece of advice, is just be that, because you also then don't have to try to figure out how to be, just be yourself, right? And you end up taking this whole thing off the table. You don't have to worry about it if you just be yourself. The other thing that I always say to people is, everyone is scared. I just want to be a little less scared. And what I mean by that is, I think we're all made up of really the same things, right? We all have certain, like, there's certain human foundational characteristics that we all share. And I think especially when it comes to like being an entrepreneur, being an actor, or taking that step into something, is that it's fearful, but you're not alone in your fear. And I noticed this a lot of times with my friends that are struggling with dating. And, you know, my one friend will, I'll say, are you asking people out? No, I'm too afraid, I'm like, well, the person you want to ask out is probably equally as afraid, right? And so if you have two people that could possibly have this wonderful relationship, but because of fear, which we all have, that doesn't have a chance to exist, then you've lost an opportunity, right? And so I always say, I just want to be a little less afraid. And in doing that, that makes me kind of step into my fear a little bit. And it's-
I think you just got a job.
Yeah, did you hear that go? That's the baby monitor going.
Oh, that's the baby monitor.
just try to step into that a little bit more instead of stepping away from it. Now, trust me, there's certain things I'm fearful of, like jumping out of airplanes, snakes. Don't need those, afraid of those. But when it comes to how I'm gonna be in the world, approaching someone, talking to someone, initiating a conversation, trying to get a meeting, whatever those things are, which create anxiety in every single one of us. I mean, the meeting you talked about yesterday, I'm sure there's still a little bit of going on before.
Oh, yeah, it's still like.
You still have that, right? And so you can't hear that voice and then use that as a reason not to take action. You have to hear that voice and go, oh, this is, maybe I need to learn from this, right? This is a fear of mine. Like, could I get over this? Is it rational? So I think we live in a world where everyone's just a little afraid. And I think that, and we have many things that we have in common, but fear is the one thing I think that we all have in common that actually holds us back. Mm. And just try to be really aware of that and try to take action in a way that allows me to kind of step up to that line a little bit, right? And challenge my own internal fear, which is all up here. It's all learned. Fear is completely learned. It's not instinctual, I don't think, unless it's snakes.
Right.
But I do think, I think a lot of fear is totally made up in our heads. And so those are the two things that I try to give advice to my friends, whether it is about dating or whether it is about setting up their own business or doing something that they haven't done before, is do it authentically and welcome the fear and step into that fear a little bit. You know, it was, and by the way, it's really easy to give that advice, right? It's not always easy for myself to do that. I really, really enjoyed my 18 years at my previous agency. But in 2013, I wrote my resignation and I held it for 5 years. Because I was afraid. And yeah, I mean, so that was something that was in my head for a long time. Yeah, some of it was, and the fear was multi-leveled, right? Like fear of failure, fear of growing out of your own. And it was also fear of losing something I was really comfortable with. I love these people. I love the clients. I love my work environment. I love the people I got to work with. So some of the fear was fear of loss, right? And in some cases, you know, growth requires moving on. And that does sometimes mean loss, but you hope it's offset by a different type of a gain that offsets that in a greater way.
Yeah. I love talking to you, Blair, because you're so honest.
Yeah, no, well, that's why, you know, I'm really, yeah, I mean, it's I really live by that. I really, really do.
What got you into the business of being an agent? Did you have some kind of a fun accidental story, or did you grow up wanting to be an agent?
Well, I will tell you a story, because this you'll get a kick out of this. So I used to be a stockbroker, right? Which is really a glorified salesperson. You know, you're selling investment options to people, whether it's stocks, bonds. So I was a stockbroker for years. I got out of that business and I was dating Gary Franco, who you know.
My dance partner.
Dance partner. And I see, I think it's dance up behind you. I see some dance stuff. And yes.
Lots of Ginger and Fred.
Yeah, there you go. And Gary said to me, because he was a dancer, he was booking work, he was complaining about his agents all the time, which is what actors do. Lovingly, right? And he's like, you should be an agent. You'd be so good. And he's like, I know some people. Right? And so I took a phone call with someone that you mentioned to me the other day on the phone, Scott Musgrove, 25 years ago, he would never remember that. 25 years ago, I talked to Scott, and then I got connected to another person who said, hey, I know an agent, why don't you take a meeting? So then I took a meeting with this agent at Abrams Arts Agency, his name is John Paradise. We went to lunch. We sat down, we had a great lunch. By the end of the lunch, he said, if you want to be my assistant, I will fire my assistant and you can be my assistant. And it's exactly what happened. He fired his assistant, I stepped in, and within a year, I was an agent. And I haven't looked back. I love what I do. You know, I love what I do. You know, I would never want to go back.
Do you think your work as a stockbroker has informed you in any way in this role?
For sure. You know, it's interesting because both roles are sales jobs, and they both sell something that's intangible, right? So when you're buying, when you're a stockbroker and you're talking to a client.
The word intangible. That's a great word.
Yeah, it is a great word.
It plays on our knowledge and intuition. It's conceptual work.
That's right. Right. And both as a stockbroker and an agent, you do that. So when you're selling an investment, you're selling the idea of what it might be like, that you're selling dreams, you're selling future, you're selling retirement, you're selling the idea of safety and feeling secure in your, perhaps your later years, or saving up for a boat, whatever that would be, right? So you're that's all idea-based. And with what I do now, we're selling. I'm not selling something that's tangible. I'm selling a personality, a style, a feeling. You know, actors are hired to fill roles because they evoke a feeling, right? Because we can all step into those roles and just recite lines if that's all we want. But there's something else that comes out of that, another feeling. And not only do we sell that to the casting people and the producers, but the people that we represent, we're helping them fulfill a dream, which is also intangible, right? Because it's something that just keeps growing that you'll never really attain. So you're just helping them on their path to fulfill their dream as well. So all those experiences are very intangible, I think. So that's how they're very similar, I think. You know, I think it would be hard to sell just like an item, like here, buy this automobile. You know, it's very specific. Has these features, it has this benefit. You either want it or you don't want it. But when you're selling stuff that's intangible, it gives you a lot of leverage and leeway to kind of mold something. Well, you know, when you're selling something intangible, two people can look at the same thing and see it very differently and see the benefits of it very, very, very differently. When you're selling an automobile, you can't really do that. It's got four tires, it's got a steering wheel, it drives this fast, it's this color, it is what it is. But things that are intangible can be positioned in a way so that the person you're trying to get to understand it might see it from one angle, and then you can present that same opportunity to someone else in a whole different way, and they see it from that angle. I think it's pretty fun, actually, to do. Yeah.
Talk about the unions again. You don't have to back up.
So I think ultimately, at the end of the day, I think what we're dealing with is companies and businesses have realized that they have to work smarter, right? And I think the companies are willing to go non-union and shoot non-union, and I don't think it's because of money to the town. I think it's just all these hoops that they have to jump through to satisfy the union requirements, right? And so the thing that I think is unfortunate is union work has always been on the cheaper side. I wish the actors collectively would still stand up for their value. You can still work on a non-union job and say, listen, I think the value is X, Y, Z, right? But they're walking in and they're doing jobs that are $500 and $700. But I've seen a lot of non-union work that also pays very, very, very well. I had a client that was a spokesperson for a cable company. She made six figures every year with this cable company, and there were years she never even had a shoot for them. She was just under contract. So there's some great non-union work that pays. But you're right, the trend is going to non-union. It puts them in a real position. They don't know whether to go financial core. You know, they want to work. You know, I always say to actors, and I'm not an actor and I'm not in the union, and I never want to get in between an actor and their union. Let me just be really clear about that. So I don't want to necessarily take a position. But when I talk to actors, and I'll say to them, I bet when you, and Michelle, I bet this happened to you. When you're 4 years old or 5 years old, you're dancing for your family, you're putting on little plays, you're performing for your grandma and grandpa. You're doing little skits, maybe over the holidays, maybe with your cousins. Actors and performers know from the time they're this big what they want to do. It's in them, it is part of who they are. And there's, unless you're a creative person, it doesn't fill you like it does, and they know when they're this big, right? So they grow up wanting to be a performer, and they want to be an actor, they want to sing, they want to paint. They want to act. They've always known that. And what I think is really unfortunate is then they reach a crossroads where they join the union, which has always been a really great kind of
milestone,
right? It's something you strive for. It's an accomplishment, right? And you tick that box and yes, now I'm in the union, which is great. But now they're at a point where they do that, and then all this other work over here goes away. So by joining the union, it now prevents you from doing all this other stuff. And I think it's a struggle for the town. I don't know. I feel bad. You know, I had a conversation with the town yesterday about this. He's like, I can't leave the union. I'm like, I understand. I'm not asking you to leave the union. I'm letting you know that I have a really hard time getting in the room because you just joined the union. And no casting director knows you. You only want to go into the union room, but those union rooms are packed with union actors that have been doing this for 20 years, and it's going to be hard to break through. And had they been willing to do some of the non-union spots to build the relationships with casting directors, ad agencies, directors, then they can still step into that union work, right? The union work is more competitive, it's just harder. Like, if you're a non-union actor and you're killing it in the non-union world, step into the union world, right? But if you haven't even been successful in the non-union world, which I believe is probably a little bit easier to play in, if you can't kill it there, then you're stepping into something that's far more difficult. You're just stepping in a group of people that just have that much more experience. And I said before that it's not about one person being a better actor or a worse, you know, just because you're non-union doesn't mean you're bad, or union that you're good. If you're in the union and you've been doing the work for, you know, 20 years, it just means you've got all the connections and you know how to audition properly, and you know the casting people, and they're gonna see you. And, you know, the same casting people, I know when I submit on a project, this casting director will always see these people. This casting director will always see, they, because everyone has their favorites. So if you're not, if you're the new guy, it's hard to get into those cliques, right? Those casting cliques. It makes it really difficult. So it's not really about your level of how good you are at that point. You just have to break in and you have to create a kind of a little bit of a name for yourself in the business, I think, even non-union.
It's unfortunate because what happens is we strive as actors for the milestone of becoming a SAG actor. I mean, I was in SAG at a very young age. But then being on the other side, being a talent agent and a manager, it's not my decision to tell them whether or not to join the union, but I have to advise based on what I think the quality and quantity of the work will be for them.
That's right.
It's also unfortunate from the business standpoint, and SAG is dealing with this with many producers with their new media and their low budgets and their modified budgets, how to allow producers who want to create good content to work with professionals without punishing their production. But also, you know, what I see is a lot of really big production called new media, and the actors are making $125 a day. So it has not worked yet, in my opinion, overall. And it's also unfortunate that we have right to work states where the union is not, where unions are not supported, let's put it that way, or it's not a state that mandates union work as being the end all be all.
That's right.
And we know what those areas are. What's interesting is some of those right to work states, like Utah, are now working more than other states and doing SAG projects because they are doing COVID friendly and they're being careful. And these are markets that were maybe a little quiet and couldn't compete. And now a lot of the work's going there because it offers producers a way to do things safer and maybe more budget friendly.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's funny that, you know, you bring up a good point. If you do a shoot here on a residential street, you gotta pull permits. You have to secure a location, right? So a house in LA, everyone knows, is like $5,000 a day-ish, give or take, right? So you gotta pay for the house, you gotta pull permits. The neighbors are sick and tired of trucks, so they're complaining. If you do an outdoor shoot in a park, the homeless now understand that they could be banging pots and there's a stack of petty cash that just pays these people off to keep them away. So that's what you deal with in LA. You go to Utah and you're like, excuse me, we'd like to shoot on your street. And they're like, great.
Yay!
We're coming out bringing fresh baked cookies for you.
Let's have a parade.
Yeah, we're supporting your production. They're thrilled, right? So even that experience is very different than it is, you know, here in LA. I have a park across the street from where we live. We have productions, not right now, but, you know, before COVID, every week. And I actually loved it because they kept the park clean. There's always activity there. But, you know, I have neighbors who are like, oh, another truck, another shoot going on, right? Yeah, it's a different world.
Well, we get very jaded here because we see it every day too.
Yeah, for sure.
An interference, is it gonna take my parking space? Do I have to drive to a different way to get to work? Where now, you know, everyone's working from home, so less people are driving. And Utah offers gorgeous, different environments, you know, something rocky here, something floral here, a forest here, a little homey road, you know, with a little tiny house, very residential, or a big city look. They can offer all of that, and it's within blocks.
Yeah.
And quieter.
For sure. You know, it's
but
funny.
About diversity. A lot of people from Utah call me because they're like, we are short on diversity. You know, it's tense. I think still even the census would say it's like 90% Caucasian. I mean, I think it's very white.
I'm sure. The You know, it's funny, I was working on a production a couple months ago when we were getting ready to open, like California was had been reopened again, I think. And the production company was very clear. They said, if this closes, we're going to either Utah or we're going to Vegas. We're going to shoot there. So tell your clients, this is a condition of the work. It might be in their backyard, but they might be, they may have to, you know. So we just have to do it.
Where are the favorite places that you've sent clients? Have you had some wonderful exotic locations or?
So I've sent, the thing I think my favorite was a client of ours that was probably 70. He'd never left the country. And he went to Italy, and I can't remember where in Italy, but I remember all the excitement of him getting a passport at that age, right? Because you have that, and you know when it's a booking, they used to do all these rushes, and I remember, you know, to get him processed so he could go, and I remember how thrilled he was to go to Italy. But I've sent people to Iceland. I've sent people to Mexico a lot, South America a lot. I feel like I've sent people to Japan, London. I've done stuff in London.
My work's taking me all over the world. I've had some of my best quote-unquote vacations working because the airline was paid for, my room was paid for, I had great per diem, and I'm actually better when I'm working but have a little bit of downtime because I love being creative and productive. I'm not really one of those people who can just lie on a beach for hours and stare at the sky. I need to be active. But I do miss that. I miss going and doing a fabulous job somewhere.
Just even other parts of the country, right? Like going up to, you know, I've had shoots up in Napa. I've had shoots in New York. You know, who doesn't love like a couple days in New York, right? You catch a couple shows. I've had shoots in Florida, you know, so yeah, it's fun.
Well, listen, we've literally been gabbing almost an hour and I haven't heard your son cry once.
Well, because he's duct taped. I'm kidding. He is such a good little boy. He's in that time, but he was a little cranky earlier. He feeds at 11, so I'm sure my partner has taken him, is feeding him, and he only cries out of necessity, right? So he's not a complainer. So when he cries,
you have a colicky baby. You have a baby who's just communicating with you.
Yeah, and when he cries, you know,
change, time to eat.
That's it. Although I think we're learning that we do 3 naps a day. And I think the morning nap, he probably isn't going to be needing much longer. He's 5 months, Michelle. He sleeps 12 hours a night.
Yeah,
we don't
I
even.
Know.
It's ridiculous. So,
yeah, you know, you're going to have a lot of moms throwing tomatoes at you because we're jealous.
We're so fortunate. Right?
I never had sleeping
pills. Not with it. We're so fortunate that he sleeps through the night. So we're probably gonna have to take out the first nap. Because he was a very cranky little boy this morning. He did not want to go down for his nap. It's like, I'm awake, Dad.
That's so sweet. I'm so excited for you for this. Well, listen, I just want to thank you so much for your time, Blynn. If you wanted to kind of encapsulate a little couple minutes, like anything else you want to add about your experience in the work or what you offer, advice, you know, or any kind of mind, spiritual, body advice, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, you know, I think it's really important, and I was telling this to my nephew who's staying, visiting us right now. We were talking last night, we were sitting outside. He's trying to figure out his life, right? He's 20 years old, really trying to figure it out. And we said, you know, the first thing I think you have to do is you got to just follow what you feel is right for you and not what other people feel is right for you. So follow your own path, you know, be the leader, be your own leader. And if you do what you love, and I know it's silly, if you do what you love, you will never work a day in your life. And I love what I do. And I think it's really important because we all have friends who are in jobs they don't like or they're in relationships that make them unhappy. And I just think that gets back to the authenticity. I'm just really about that. Just every day, you know, every day is really important. And if you're not happy today, and you weren't happy yesterday, you have to fix it or change it so that you can make yourself happy tomorrow. And we have to make change, and settling into mediocrity for me doesn't work. I don't find that rewarding at all. And so I just tell people, take a little bit of a risk, try something you haven't done, whether it's my nephew where I say, who cares, move to another city, try this out, go work there, just play in the world, right? Just let yourself play in the world. And you'll be really surprised what you'll find out and what you'll learn. And I think that it's really important. And I'd like to surround myself with people that do that. And that's also important that you surround yourself with the people that elevate you, right? They say, well, you take your five best friends and you're a combination of your five best friends, you mold them all together and that's who you are. And I think that's really, really important. I will tell you, I will close just by saying that I love what I do. You know, I really, really love what I do. I couldn't imagine being on camera. Even this, although I'm totally okay with this, could really put me into a tailspin, like, I'm just not meant to be on camera. And nor does it even sound exciting for me, but I love what I do for those people that want to be on camera. And I just love it, you know? We're always looking for new talent. So people are always welcome to reach out.
How should they reach out to you, Blair?
What?
How should people reach out to you?
I would reach out through my email, which is Blair, B-L-A-I-R, at TaylorTalentServices.com. And my website is TaylorTalentServices.com. You can see a cute picture of me, see some work I've done, see how fabulous I am.
You are fabulous. Well, I probably have 10 more questions, but I'm gonna save them for another day.
Perfect.
Because I know you have to get back to your son, and thank your partner, Jason, for allowing you to spend time with me.
Of course.
And my dog is also about to do voice exercises. It's time for his walk. So, big, big virtual hug.
And thank you, Michelle, anytime. I'm here anytime you want to talk, either on camera or just one-on-one.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.